Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1145, The Uyghurs and the Destabilization of China, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 10th of the year 2020. This program is an extension of coverage that we have really been engaged in since the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks, and that concerns the largely Islamic and Turkophone, meaning Turkic-speaking people of Xinjiang province in China. In addition to their affiliation with Islamic fascist offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, such as Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, the Uyghur people, or Uyghur people, sometimes it's pronounced U-I, sometimes spelled U-Y-G-H-U-R, are a minority in China that have been a major focal point of destabilization efforts by Western intelligence, including CIA, since the early 1950s. The fellow who was the father figure, so to speak, of the contemporary Uyghur movement was Issa Yusuf Alptekin, A-L-P-T-E-K-I-N, an ally of Chiang Kai-shek and his narco-fascist government in China during World War II and in the immediate aftermath of the Chinese Civil War. As we have seen, the Uyghur milieu has been a major focal point not only of propaganda in this and other countries, with the allegation being made that millions of Uyghurs were in re-education centers in the mineral-rich and petroleum-rich Xinjiang province. This despite things that would cast aspersions on that claim. For example, one of the claims that was made in that regard comes from the Network of Chinese Human Rights Defenders, which is a U.S. intel front financed by the U.S. government, and they came up with their statistical analysis on the basis of eight interviews, this in an area that has a population of 20 million. In addition, a German-born national named Adrian Zenz, who is a fellow with the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, another U.S. intel front and something that is a direct offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee and the OUNB and ABN milieu that we've looked at for so many different years, most recently in connection with the elevation of the OUNB successor organizations to power in contemporary Ukraine. One of the things that we have been looking at in the series we're doing here, and that also figured in a big way in our analysis of the, quote, pro-democracy, unquote, movement in Hong Kong and their destabilization, is the National Endowment for Democracy, a U.S. intelligence cutout co-founded by William Casey when he was head of the CIA, and along with other U.S. intel cutouts, such as the aforementioned Network of Chinese Human Rights Defenders, the NED, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, Radio Free Liberty, Freedom House, basically the impetus for the claims that have been taken more or less at face value and used as the justification for various types of sanction behavior vis-a-vis or performed by the U.S. and its allies. The fact of the matter is that the claims themselves of 2 million, however many Uyghurs involved in or interned in, quote, re-education centers, unquote, not only are a suspect from a methodological standpoint, if, for example, you want to get an accurate picture of what's going on in an area with a population of 20 million, you don't conduct 8 interviews and then run those interviews through a filter that is basically governed by U.S. intelligence and governmental propaganda assets. That is, in fact, being done vis-a-vis the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. And as we have noted, in addition to the Islamic fascist offshoots such as Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, with which elements of the Uyghurs have been affiliated, we also have seen associations between the Uyghurs and the secular Turkish or pan-Turkic fascists of Alparslan Turkish and the National Movement Party. We will touch again on those. In addition to those, the Uyghurs have obviously also, as we looked at in our first two shows, have been networking with the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations slash WACL slash OUNB milieu with people like Ruzi Nazar, who represented the ABN at the 1984 WACL conference in Dallas. People like that networking with the Uyghurs going all the way back to the 1950s. Again, the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, another U.S. intel front, is an offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee. We will restate many of the salient points of discussion here. However, we're going to finish with the reading of an article that we began with in, for the record, 1144. This article is from the Gray Zone of March 5th of 2020. It is by Ajit, A-J-I-T, last name Singh, capital S-I-N-G-H, and it is titled Inside the World Uyghur Congress, the U.S.-backed right-wing regime change network seeking the fall of China, unquote. And we are going to resume discussion with the World Uyghur Congress, basically a regime change entity financed in considerable measure by the U.S. government and various intel offshoots of same, such as the aforementioned National Endowment for Democracy. Resuming and overlapping with what we looked at in our last program, the current president of the WUC is Dolkun, capital D-O-L-K-U-N, Issa, capital I-S-A, winner of the 2019 Democracy Award from the NED. In 2016, Issa received the Human Rights Award from the far-right Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, again an offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee, which was established by the U.S. government in 1993. In his acceptance speech, Issa emphasized, quote, the Uyghurs' resistance to communism, unquote, and again quoting, we will not stop our work until we consign this destructive ideology, in the words of Ronald Reagan, quote, to the ash heap of history, unquote. Issa regularly lobbies U.S. and Western politicians to intensify their new Cold War agenda by enacting economic sanctions and curbing ties with China. Among those he has met with in recent years are Trump administration White House officials, right-wing Republican Senator Ted Cruz, and the fervently anti-China acting director of National Intelligence, Richard Grenell, G-R-E-N-E-L-L. In November of 2019, Issa attended the Halifax International Security Forum, a gathering convened by NATO and the Canadian Department of National Defense. There, he met with leading Western political and military figures. In January of 2020, Issa was hosted at an event organized by the Board of Deputies of British Jews, a right-wing British-Israeli lobby group. At the event, Issa met with the ultra-Zionist organization B'nai Akiva, A-K-I-V-A, whose leader called for the Israeli army, quote, to take the foreskins of 300 Palestinians, unquote, amid Israel's punishing 2014 assault on the besieged Gaza Strip. Omar Kanat serves as the WUC's chairman of the executive committee. Kanat, K-A-N-A-T, helped found the WUC and has been a permanent fixture in its executive leadership. The veteran operative has a lengthy history of work with the U.S. government, from serving as senior editor of Radio Free Asia's Uyghur service from 1999 to 2009, to covering the U.S. wars on Iraq and Afghanistan, and interviewing the Dalai Lama for the Radio Free Asia network. In an interview with the Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal at the 2018 NED Awards ceremony in the U.S. Capitol building, Kanat took credit for furnishing many of the claims about internment camps in Xinjiang to Western media. I'm going to reread this last sentence because, again, these are the types of sources who have been referenced by people like Adrian Zenz, institutions like the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, again, an offshoot of the ABN-OUNB, maybe we've looked at many times, elements like the Network of Chinese Human Rights Defenders are using documentation, unquote, like this. So again, this is worth noting. In an interview with the Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal at the 2018 NED Awards ceremony in the U.S. Capitol building, Kanat took credit for furnishing many of the claims about internment camps in Xinjiang to Western media. He conceded, however, that the WUC did not know how the oft-repeated millions detained, unquote, claim was arrived at, aside from, quote, Western media estimates, unquote. And the next section, preparing for a color revolution, WUC offshoots staff up with national security state operatives. Now, what we're going to look at in this section of the Ajit Singh Gray Zone article from March 5th of this year is basically at as above, so below. There are various offshoots of the World Uyghur Congress, and all of these work hand in glove with various U.S. intel cutouts, like the aforementioned NED. Ajit Singh writes, established in 1998, the Uyghur American Association, or UAA, is a Washington, D.C.-based affiliate of the WUC. A longtime grantee of the NED, the UAA has received millions of dollars in funding. According to its publicly available tax filings, the group works closely with the U.S. government, particularly the U.S. State Department, Congressional Executive Commission on China, and the U.S. Congress's Human Rights Commission. The National Endowment for Democracy has been exceptionally supportive of UAA, stated Nuri Nury Turkel, T-U-R-K-E-L, former UAA president, quote, providing us with invaluable guidance and assistance, unquote, along with, again, quoting, essential funding, unquote. Turkel credited the NED with enabling the UAA to increase its credibility and expand its influence. Among the top achievements he cited was a meeting with the new Kyrgyzstan government, quote, within weeks of the former government's fall from power, unquote, following the U.S.-engineered Tulip Color Revolution, unquote, which brought a pro-Western regime to power. Speaking at the Fifth Congress of the UAA in 2006, Turkel confirmed the regime change agenda of the UAA, UHRP, and broader Uyghur separatist movement, stating that, quote, as we witnessed the Tulip Revolution, unquote, and the toppling of the former government of Kyrgyzstan, our hopes were again reinforced, unquote. The UAA's leadership consists of U.S. national security state operators, including employees of the U.S. government, Radio Free Asia, and Military Industrial Complex. Kuzap, K-U-Z-Z-A-T, Altay, capital A-L-T-A-Y, the nephew of Rebbe Kadir, is the current president of the UAA. Altay is also the founder of the Uyghur Entrepreneur Network, which claims to offer Uyghur Americans with guidance to, quote, start their own business, unquote. In 2019, his business network has organized an event in collaboration with the FBI, the federal law enforcement agency notorious for its surveillance of Muslim Americans and ensnaring countless mentally troubled young Muslim American men in manufactured terror plots. Past presidents of UAA include Kadir, Alim Seypoff, S-E-Y-P-O-F-F, a former Radio Free Asia correspondent and director, current director of RFA's Uyghur Service, and Ishat Hassan Kokbore, K-O-K-B-O-R-E, who has worked at Booz Allen Hamilton since 2008. Again, Booz Allen Hamilton, another very common U.S. intelligence and national security-connected organization. Continuing, the main project spun out of the UAA and the MEB is the Uyghur Human Rights Project, or UHRP. The UHRP was founded by the UAA in 2004 with the MEB as the principal source of funding. The MEB granted the UHRP a whopping $1,244,698 between 2016 and 2019. The UHRP is staffed by WUC leaders like Omar Kanat, K-A-N-A-T, and Nuri Turkel, T-U-R-K-E-L, along with former U.S. government officials and senior members of the MEB. Dr. Elise Anderson serves as UHRP's Senior Program Office for Research and Advocacy. In 2019, Anderson served as the Liu Xiaobo Fellow, occupying a position at the Congressional Executive Commission on China, named for the far-right Chinese dissident who supported colonialism, U.S. militarism, and the, quote, westernization, unquote, of China. Anderson states that from 2012 to 2016, quote, she was based out of Urumqi, the regional capital of Xinjiang, unquote, conducting research for her doctorate. The extent of her activities in the region are unclear, as Anderson's CV indicates that during this time she was also working for the U.S. government as, quote, Urumqi warden for the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, China, 2014 to 2016. Louisa Cohn-Greve, last name capital C-O-A-N, capital G-R-E-V-E, the former vice president of MEB, today serves as UHRP's director of global advocacy. Greve formerly worked as vice president of the MEB. Rushan Abbas, the U.S. National Security State's favorite human rights activist, unquote. Another influential organization spun out of the WUC network is the Campaign for Uyghurs. The group is headed by Rushan, R-U-S-H-A-N, Abbas, capital A-B-B-A-S, the former vice president of the UAA. Promoted simply as a, quote, Uyghur human rights activist, unquote, by Western media outlets, including the supposedly adversarial Democracy Now! Of Amy Goodman, Abbas is, in fact, a longtime U.S. government and military operative. One more time. Speaking of the Campaign for Uyghurs, this group is headed by Rushan Abbas, A-B-B-A-S, the former vice president of the UAA. Promoted simply as a Uyghur human rights activist, unquote, by Western media outlets, including the supposedly adversarial Democracy Now! Of Amy Goodman, Abbas is, in fact, a longtime U.S. government and military operative. Abbas boasts in her bio of her, quote, extensive experience working with the U.S. government agencies, including Homeland Security, the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and various U.S. intelligence agencies, unquote. While working for the military contractor L3 Technologies, Abbas served the U.S. government and the Bush administration's so-called war on terror as a, quote, consultant at Guantanamo Bay supporting Operation Enduring Freedom, unquote. Abbas, again quoting, also worked as a linguist and translator for several federal agencies, including work for the U.S. State Department in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and for President George W. Bush and former First Lady Laura Bush, unquote. Like so many of her colleagues, Abbas enjoyed a stint at Radio Free Asia, unquote. While Abbas once shared her history of collaboration with the U.S. government in the open, she has attempted to scrub biographic information from her online presence following a disastrous publicity appearance in December of 2019. During a Reddit's Ask Me Anything question and answer forum, participants blasted Abbas as a CIA asset, unquote, and frequent U.S. government collaborator, prompting her attempt to disappear her bio from the Internet. Besides collaborating with the U.S. government, Abbas's professional experience consists of aiding the expansion of U.S. capitalism in the global South. She boasts of work with consulting firms such as ISI Consultants, which, quote, assists U.S. companies to grow their business in Middle East and African markets, unquote. Abbas claims to have, again quoting, over 15 years of experience in global business development, strategic business analysis, business consultancy, and government affairs throughout the Middle East, Africa, the CIS regions, Europe, Asia, Australia, North America, and Latin America. We're going to come back to the Grey Wolf and National Action or National Movement Party link to the Uyghurs in just a minute. But I want to point out that Rushan Abbas has boasted in her bio of working for the U.S. government at Guantanamo supporting Operation Enduring Freedom. One of the things that I noted in the in For the Record program number 1140, once again, the U.S. ambassador to South Korea, with so much going on there, including, frankly, the suspicious death of Park Won-soon. The U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Admiral Harry Harris Jr., is a very important individual, formerly chief of naval operations. He also has a background not only as a commandant at Guantanamo, but also working with counterterrorism and anti-submarine warfare operations. ASW and counterterrorism, very strong intel-connected naval functions, and I think it is probable that the aforementioned Harry Harris is in his position as U.S. ambassador to South Korea as part of the full court press by the U.S. against China. And noting that the Uyghurs have worked with the Guantanamo establishment in connection with intelligence, connected matters is something to note here. One wonders if perhaps some of Admiral Harris's or Ambassador Harris's duties involve networking with the various Uyghur organizations. And again, note that Rushan Abbas has been held up uncritically as a victim of oppression on Democracy Now! And many other so-called progressive outlets have basically uncritically presented these arguments about the Uyghurs. Now, yet another connection of the Uyghurs, and that is to the pan-Turkist fascist milieu of Alparslan Turkesh and the National Action or National Movement Party and the Grey Wolves. We have looked at ARPA Slam Prakash in many past programs, including AFA Program 14 and AFA Program number 21. Prakash was an advocate of having Turkey come into World War II on the side of the Axis, and was at one point Turkey's ambassador to NATO. He also, again, is a long-time pan-Turkist fascist, head of the National Action or National Movement Party, whose youth wing, the Grey Wolves, were set up as the Turkish wing of the Stay Behind networks, or Gladio networks, that we've looked at so many times in the past. Note that a fellow who was a CIA contact with the National Action or National Movement Party at the same time as Mehmet Ali Eja of the Grey Wolves shot Pope John Paul II, was the aforementioned Ruzi Nazar, Ruzi Nazar of the Turkestan Legion, Ruzi Nazar of the Durlavonga Brigade, Ruzi Nazar of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and Ruzi Nazar networking with the Uyghur milieu as well on behalf of organizations like the milieu of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Now, another of the many fascist connections to the Uyghurs are the Grey Wolves and their parent National Action Party. Returning once again to the Ajit Singh Grey Zone article, Inside the World Uyghur Congress, the U.S.-backed right-wing regime change network seeking the fall of China. Along with their extensive ties to Washington, the WUC, and Uyghur separatist movement has maintained close connections with the Turkish far right. In 2015, members of the MHP-affiliated Grey Wolves, formerly led by Alparslan Perkesh, attacked South Korean tourists in Turkey, mistaking them for Chinese citizens in protest of the situation in Xinjiang. Turkish MHP party leader Devlet Bahçeli, B-A-H-C-E-L-I, defended the attack, saying, "How are you going to differentiate between Koreans and Chinese?" Unquote. The rightist politician questioned. Again, quoting, "They both have slanted eyes. Does it really matter?" Unquote. Bahçeli's racist remarks coincided with the display of a Grey Wolves banner at the party's Istanbul headquarters, reading, quote, "We crave Chinese blood," unquote. The Grey Wolves and Uyghur militants were blamed by Thailand's National Police and an IHS Jains analyst of carrying out a 2015 bombing of a religious shrine in Thailand that killed 20 people. The attack was intended as revenge against the Thai government's decision to repatriate a group of Uyghur Muslims to China. Beijing had claimed that the Uyghurs were en route to Turkey, Syria, or Iraq to join extremist groups fighting in the region, such as the Al-Qaeda-affiliated East Turkestan Islamic Movement, or ETIM, or the Turkestan Islamic Party, or TIP. Months before the bombing, a group of 200 protesters waving East Turkestan flags attacked the Thai consulate in Istanbul in response to the Uyghur repatriation. The group was reportedly led by the Grey Wolves and the East Turkestan Culture and Solidarity Association. The latter organization was headed by Sayet, S-E-Y-I-T, Tunturk, T-U-N-T-U-R-K, who served as World Uyghur Congress Vice President from 2008 to 2016 and belonged to the organization's founding pantheon. The World Uyghur Congress continues to publish articles on its website that praise and celebrate Arpaslan Perkesh, the far-right ultra-nationalist founder of the Grey Wolves and longtime MHP party leader. His website also promotes endorsements of East Turkestan separatism by current leaders of the MHP and the Grey Wolves. While building links with the Turkish far right, leading World Uyghur Congress representatives have appealed to Turkish President Erdogan to take an interventionist role in China, akin to Turkey's actions in Libya and Syria, where it supported the regime change efforts of the U.S., West, and an array of extremist proxy groups. Writing in the Wall Street Journal in 2012, Nuri Turkel argued that Turkey can play a leading role, quote, in rallying democracies to pressure China on Xinjiang, quote, as a long-standing ally of the U.S. and a neighbor of Europe, Turkey is uniquely well-situated to do this, unquote. As a first step in this strategy, Turkel proposed that Turkey, quote, should organize a Friends of Uyghurs conference with democratic allies similar to the ones organized for Libya and Syria, discussing Ankara's vision and policy objectives with respect to the Uyghur people in China. A Turkish soldier of the occupying force in the northwest Syria town of Atareb flashed the Grey Wolves hand sign to an Agence France Presse photographer. The Grey Wolves are an openly fascist Turkish ultra-nationalist movement in Turkey who hold deeply racist hatred toward the Kurds. Other leading representatives of the World Uyghur Congress have vocally endorsed Turkish military interventionism. The political statements of Seyit Tuntürk, who served as World Uyghur Congress vice president, underscores the extremist and militant politics behind the World Uyghur Congress's carefully cultivated image as a, quote, peaceful and nonviolent, unquote, human rights organization. In 2018, former WUC Vice President Tuntürk declared that Chinese Uyghurs view Turkish, quote, state requests as orders, unquote. He then proclaimed that hundreds of thousands of Chinese Uyghurs were ready to enlist in the Turkish army and to join Turkey's illegal and brutal invasion of northern Syria to, quote, fight for God, unquote, if ordered to do so by Erdogan. Shortly after Tuntürk's comments, Uyghur militants dressed in Turkish military fatigues and on the Turkish side of the Syrian border released a video in which they threatened to wage war against China. Quote, listen, you dog bastards, do you see this? We will triumph, unquote, one fighter exclaimed, again quoting, we will kill you all. Listen up, Chinese civilians. Get out of our East Turkestan. I am warning you. We shall return and we will be victorious, unquote. Again, doesn't sound all that peaceful. Note that the bombing in Thailand in 2015 was after a group of Uyghurs were repatriated to China. And according to the Chinese, they were on their way to join one of the Islamic organizations in Syria. Certainly the Uyghurs have historical links to both Al-Qaeda and to the Islamic State, as well as to the secular pan-Turkish fascists of the Grey Wolf / National Action Party milieu. Again, something to note in a big way, in connection with the Uyghurs per se, note how much of the propaganda that we are seeing and how many of the organizations themselves either come from or are networked with various U.S. intelligence cutouts. Also, I was just struck by something that Americans take more or less for granted, which is our rights to, or our right to interfere in the affairs of other countries. Just imagine that, say, in China, the Chinese government were channeling funds to leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. Suppose also that leading Chinese political figures were meeting with various activists from the Black Lives Matter movement, and that instead of the largely peaceful demonstrations, there certainly has been X amount of violence, some of it perhaps coming from some of the Black Bloc people and the Antifa people, some of it also undoubtedly coming from right-wing agents provocateur, some of which were affiliated with the Boogaloo movement, some of which had other connections. The point being that the demonstrations themselves were, for the most part, peaceful. Some there was X amount of violence, but suppose that the Black Lives Matter demonstrations engaged in the kind of activity that we saw in Hong Kong. Suppose they were smashing subway stations, derailing subway trains, throwing Molotov cocktails at cops, and the whole time singing the Star Spangled, or singing the Chinese national anthem. Instead, the protesters, unquote, in Hong Kong were singing the Star Spangled Banner. Suppose they were singing the Chinese national anthem and waving the Chinese national flag. This would be seen as an act of war in the U.S. We would not be standing for this. The overt and covert operations against China, which this past week got impetus from Donald Trump declaring that the TikTok and another app, I don't do apps myself, but the TikTok and another app will not be allowed in the U.S., supposedly because they present a threat to U.S. national security. It is amazing to me that the full court press against China and the overt and covert operations against China, both the MEDs, more or less above board financing of political opposition, some of the more covert activities such as those engaged in by the Uyghurs in China, it has really not occurred to Americans to look at the COVID-19 outbreak against the background of this full court press against China, with both sanctions being declared almost daily now in the U.S., with various U.S. intelligence cutouts such as the NED, the Network of Chinese Human Rights Defenders, the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, the Jamestown Foundation. If these were financing the Black Lives Matter movement, and if we saw the kinds of activities on behalf of the Black Lives Matter movement, as we saw in connection with Hong Kong, that would be considered an act of war in the U.S. But Americans take these things lying down. They don't think twice about them. And again, I'm going into detail here in order to present some background with regard to the political context in which the COVID-19 outbreak has occurred. That is basically being blamed on China. I think the evidence is quite strong that that is in fact a false flag operation. Some of the details are technical, but we've spoken about those in the past, and again, that landmark Whitney Webb article I think serves as something of a foundation for the scholarship in that regard. The various organizations that we have looked at in connection with the Uyghurs and the destabilization of China, many of these have their genesis when the aforementioned William Casey was president, or was not president, but the head of the CIA after having managed Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign. William Casey, as we have looked at in many programs, handled the State Department machinations to bring in the Eastern European SS-linked, Galen-linked fascist organizations that ultimately matured into the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Organization. That is literally a Nazi wing of the Republican Party, and it was a domestic outgrowth of a program that also abroad financed the Fascist Freedom Fighters program. William Casey was sent by Alan Bullis to manage the OSS agents in Germany in late 1944 and 1945. That appears to have been when William Casey used his intel connections to get many of the Iron Guardists, the OUNB people, the Bulgarian National Front people, some of the Croatian Ustashi, and the other, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, and other Eastern European fascist organizations that were affiliated with the Reinhard-Galen spy outfit and that matured into the Nazi branch of the Republican Party, which is allied with organizations like the Captive Nations Committee and the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation that is an outgrowth of that. William Casey is a very important person. The Jamestown Foundation was founded on his watch. The National Endowment for Democracy was co-founded by William Casey, and the Network of Chinese Human Rights Defenders also appears to have been, to a large extent, a William Casey creation. What we're going to do to conclude our program is to take a look at William Casey. He is an individual who has worn many, many hats indeed, and perhaps in a future program we'll go into his background at greater length. It looks very much like not only was Casey involved with the Reinhard-Galen spy outfit, there are indications that he may very well have been involved with the Bormann Network, and certainly William Casey was involved with other former intelligence agency officers involved with the development of Capital Cities Incorporated. In addition, William Casey was deeply involved with the black gold milieu stemming from the Operation Golden Lily program in Asia and the black gold that was brought from Europe under the auspices of the Third Reich and the Bormann organization. What we're going to look at is the development of what the authors of this book, Peggy and Sterling Segre, termed the privatization of national security matters, noting that various right-wing organizations like the John Birch Society, one of whose founders was Fred Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, Mike Pompeo is a protege of the Koch brothers, but organizations like the Moonies, the John Birch Society, the World Anti-Communist League, and its branches, the Asian People's Anti-Communist League and the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. These organizations have been deeply involved with the intelligence community and with securing much of this black gold or illicit wealth to help finance their own national security activities. And the Segres talk about William Casey in this context. A perfect example is William Casey. Casey was one of the original OSS crowd. After law school, he went to work for an accounting firm but kept in touch with fellow lawyer John Pop Howley, H-O-W-L-E-Y, who worked for Wild Bill Donovan's law firm Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine. When Donovan became head of the OSS, Casey and Holly joined him there. Casey was John Singlob's case officer in the war, while Paul Helliwell was Singlob's direct superior. John Singlob, was one of the founders of the American branch of the World Anti-Communist League, and Paul Helliwell is a major player in the U.S. intelligence milieu and set up many of the CIA's air proprietary organizations. Resuming with this last sentence, Casey was John Singlob's case officer in the war, while Paul Helliwell was Singlob's direct superior. Casey also was a close friend of Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, working with Ray Klein, and later became involved with Lansdale as Santa Romana's torture of Major Kojima was bearing fruit. Major Kojima was the driver for General Yamashita in the Philippines, and it actually looks as though the alleged torture of Major Kojima, which then led to the discovery of the Golden Lily caches, I suspect that that was a cover for something that was already arranged during the war. This is not to find fault with the Seagraves or their research, but I suspect that the discovery, unquote, of the Golden Lily caches was basically conducted through the kind of networking that we saw in Europe vis-a-vis the Bormann Organization and the Reinhard-Galen outfit and their networking with people like Alan Dulles and William Casey, which resulted ultimately in the maturation of the ABM milieu as part of the Republican Party. Of Casey's position in connection with Major Kojima and General Yamashita. This put Casey in position to know a great deal about the Black Eagle Trust, and one of our sources insists that Casey's financial skills made him one of the key players, along with Paul Helliwell and Edwin Pauley, in implementing the Black Eagle Trust under the guidance of Robert B. Anderson and John J. McCloy. Following the war, Casey and his old friend Howell founded their own Wall Street law firm. But what made Casey really wealthy was his involvement with other former intelligence officers in setting up the media holding company Capital Cities in 1954. According to many investigators, during this period, the CIA poured millions into setting up front companies for covert operations in broadcasting and publishing, and it is alleged that Casey funneled some of these funds into capital cities to acquire failing media companies and turn them around. It is likely that Casey never left the agency, but only molted into one of its financial butterflies. It would not be the first time a senior CIA agent has had a double career on Wall Street, Alan Dulles being but one of many others. From 1971 to 1973, Casey was Nixon's appointee as chief of the Securities and Exchange Commission, where he worked closely with SEC attorney Stanley Sporkin, later appointed by Casey as CIA general counsel and involved in the Norbert Schley case. Casey also served as Nixon's Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs and chairman of the Export-Import Bank. In 1978, Casey founded a think tank called the Manhattan Institute that absorbed a number of former CIA officers and funneled money from conservative foundations to gov-conservative authors. When Casey left Capital Cities to head the Reagan presidential campaign and then to become Reagan's director of the CIA, he is said to have been its biggest single stockholder with $7.5 million in Capital Cities stock. He was still its biggest stockholder and CIA director in 1985 when Capital Cities bought ABC. a man who was involved in covert financial operations throughout his entire career. Casey had links to all the key players in this book. His DNA is all over the place, from pre-Sampi to post-Marcos. He was one of the men who dreamed up the privatization of the CIA, and as CIA director, he showed President Reagan how to implement it. One of Reagan's first acts was to sign Executive Order 12333, which authorized the CIA and other government agencies to enter into contracts with private military foundations, quote, and need not reveal the sponsorship of such contracts or arrangements for authorized intelligence purposes, unquote. This put Casey back in harness with Klein, Singlaub, Shackley, Lansdale, and many others purged earlier, while obscuring their activities, keeping them theoretically at least in the private domain. Simultaneously, Casey personally took over handling President Marcos, pressing him to provide black gold for covert purposes, and finally masterminded the downfall and removal of Marcos and his bullion. Eventually, the Iran-Contra scandal revealed the intimate bonds between members of the enterprise and unelected officials of the National Security Council, Pentagon, and the CIA. And more about this and how they overlapped with many of these right-wing organizations. Again, from Gold Warriors. Many of these clever and aggressive men regrouped privately with funding from hard-right organizations like the Birch Society, the Moonies, the World Anti-Communist League, and wealthy conservative tycoons. Like Santi's umbrella organization, that is Santa Romana, the head of the Philippines Gold Network under the Black Gold umbrella. Like Santi's umbrella organization, the enterprise grew into a powerful and influential network during the late 1980s. Although they were now private citizens, these men continued to have close ties to serving military officers, to top men in the CIA, and the armed services. This overlap made it nearly impossible to distinguish between official U.S. government operations and those that had private objectives. This was especially true because so many of these individuals had long experience in covert operations, deception, and the clandestine use of government resources and secret funds. They were accustomed to working with CIA proprietaries that had every appearance of being legitimate companies in private industry, but were actually Trojan horses for the intelligence community and, by extension, for the armed forces. In fact, some of the private military foundations were little more than fronts set up so that generals, admirals, and former spooks could continue to draw salaries and pensions as if they had never left government service. Many CIA agents spent years or even decades under various covers, so it was hard to establish beyond any doubt whether they ever left the agency or merely went underground. And again, as they point out, a perfect example is William Casey. And continuing with what the Seagraves, or how the Seagraves synopsize this relationship. And this, by the way, is the background against which the World Uyghur Congress and its many overlapping subsidiaries and the various U.S. intelligence-connected organizations that are advancing its cause and that are basically taking its claims at face value. And again, the background that we're talking about here, it's the background against which the Uyghurs and that aspect of the destabilization of China is taking place. And again, the destabilization of China is the background against which the COVID-19 outbreak must be viewed, in my opinion. Wrapping up the Segre's synopsis and overlapping that with what we've already read. Eventually, Iran-Contra revealed the intimate bonds between members of the Enterprise and unelected officials of the National Security Council, Pentagon, and CIA. Such overlap can be useful for the government when, for example, it had Lansdale subcontract to the Mafia the assassination of Fidel Castro. Having PMS trained death squads in other countries enabled the White House to carry out secret foreign policy objectives, including murder and proxy military operations inside countries with which the U.S. was not at war. It was like putting on surgical gloves and a condom to carry out the British side of foreign policy without leaving fingerprints or DNA. Should bureaucrats be allowed to get away with murder for hire? Does this not lead to serial killing and other addictions, unquote? Other addictions, question mark? Continuing. Along the way, a surprising number of retired generals, admirals, and senior officials from the National Security Council became involved in treasure hunting in the Philippines and the covert movement of gold from Manila. Overlap in this case may have been used both to advance foreign policy objectives and to enrich and finance private military forces whose secret agenda is exclusively that of the far right. Some of the best-known figures in the Enterprise, like Lansdale, Ray Klein, and John Singlaub, began their careers with OSS in World War II and rose rapidly during the Truman and Eisenhower administrations when Nazi and Japanese gold was first used to set up black bag operations like the M Fund. Their political views as Cold Warriors were shaped as they tried to rescue Generalissimo Chiang, put the Shah in power in Iran, sought to remove Sukarno and Castro, helped arrange the overthrow of Allende in Chile, and had carte blanche to dispose of inconvenient civilians in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. Lansdale was still a colonel on active duty. Beginning again, Lansdale, while still a colonel on active duty, ran Operation Mongoose, the effort to kill Castro. Once Lansdale was forced to retire by President Kennedy, he simply went private, becoming a charter member of the Enterprise, and remained a ringleader till his death in 1987. And again, that Enterprise is the background against which the Uyghurs and the destabilization of China should be seen, and the many fascist overlaps from the ABN milieu and the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation / Captive Nations milieu to the Grey Wolves and the National Action Party, the narco-fascists of Chiang Kai-shek, with whom the Alpekin Uyghur milieu was involved back in the 1940s, and also the Islamic fascist terrorist offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, all part of the Uyghur milieu. This concludes For the Record program number 1145, The Uyghurs and the Destabilization of China, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 10th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.